I call the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee to order on Tuesday, February 19th, 2015. Let the record reflect that it is 1:31 p.m. Present, myself, Senator Costello, Vice Chair Senator Giesel, welcome, and Senator Ellis, Senator Meyer, and Senator Stevens are expected shortly. And I also want to welcome the recording secretary, Carrie, and also helping us from the Juneau LIO, Jessica. Thank you for your help today. On today's agenda, we will be hearing first Senate Bill 5 involving restitution, property, and income loss, introduced by Senator Michicki. And that bill will be followed by Senate Bill 39, introduced by Senator Stoltz, the repeal of the film production tax credit. And I would like to mention that there's significant interest in Senate Bill 39, so we will be hearing the bill today from the sponsor, and we will hear from the Department of Revenue, and then we will be holding that bill and having public testimony on Senate Bill 39 on Tuesday. There will be a few confirmations we'll have that day, Senate Bill 33 and 34 from the administration, and then we will dedicate the rest of that that committee hearing to public testimony on Senate Bill 39. Certainly welcome those listening in for that bill, but I just wanted to let you know in advance of the meeting today that that's the plan for Senate Bill 39. With that, I'd like to thank Senator Michicki and welcome you and your staff, Mr. Kopp, to present your bill.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for hearing Senate Bill 5 today. This bill really is about making it right for, the way I like to put it is it puts the rights of the victim just a little bit ahead of the rights of the perpetrator. Property theft crime in Alaska is a real scourge on all Alaskans, and particularly on small businesses. According to the Department of Public Safety's annual report, Crime in Alaska 2013, Alaskans suffered over $23 million in loss due to property crimes in 2013, up more than 12% from 2011. Truly, we need to do all we can to ensure our laws work for and not against restitution of victims of property crimes. Well, Senate Bill 5 does a couple of things. It strengthens Alaska's restitution laws to restore crime victims to a pre-offense condition. So it amends and reconciles our two restitution statutes to make it clear for the courts that our public policy favors requiring criminals to compensate victims for their loss, which includes loss of income.
And we've been joined by Senator Stevens. Welcome.
It also defines loss of income as the total loss of income a business or person suffers as a result of not having stolen property available during the time it takes to obtain a replacement. And it gives direction to the courts in making determinations of loss for restitution to value property as the market value of the property. So it adopts current language in our criminal property theft statutes used by the courts to make determination of a value in criminal cases. And I'll just give you a little analogy. If you think about a roll of copper wire being stolen from a job site, the theft of the property involves a loss to the owner that is much greater than the actual cost of the item itself. So a contractor's loss of a roll of copper wire may be $2,500 for the copper, but in many cases another $10,000 or $20,000 in other costs due to offsetting a subcontractor or delaying a lengthy work schedule or whatever it takes to get them whole again in the future. It also addresses, the bill also addresses a recent appellate court decision, Welsh versus State of Alaska, which we believe adversely affects restorative justice principles and will be quite harmful to Alaskans and small businesses going forward. In that case, the court overruled a lower court decision awarding market value restitution to a victim of a property theft, stating the crime victim's loss of income should not be considered because it represents an unjust enrichment of the crime victim. And I think what's missing from the courts is realizing what it takes to just, as example, put that item on the shelf. It's just not the purchase price of that item. It's the labor to store it. It's what they spent on cooking the item, if it's a food object, or storage, or rent, or health care, or the other things that go into the unit cost of every item on a shelf. So We're asking that businesses be allowed to be kept whole and that those considerations go forward in the courts, again, to make sure that we're practicing the most effective methods of restorative justice. So with that, I am running another committee meeting. Madam Chair, if it's okay, I'd like to hand it off to my very capable staff, Chuck Kopp, to cover the remainder of the bill.
Absolutely, and thank you for coming in person to explain your legislation.
Thank you.
Thanks, sir.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Chuck Kopp, staff to Senator Machicki. The case that Senator Machicki referenced was Lori Welsh v. State of Alaska. And just briefly, the facts of that case were the defendant, Ms. Welsh, stole pills from a veterinary clinic, and the district court ordered Welsh to pay restitution to the clinic for the retail value of the pills, for the market price, the amount for which the pills would have sold to a paying customer. And the rationale the district court used was that the restitution should be based on retail versus the wholesale value so that the defendant would not obtain a better result by stealing the pills than if they had purchased the pills outright. Well, this case was appealed, and Welsh argued the district court should have ordered restitution for the wholesale value of the pills, the amount the clinic actually paid. And the appellate court reversed the district court because there were two seemingly competing restitution statutes. One in your handout is 1255045, which deals with restitution as a provision of a defendant's sentence. And when you were ordered to pay restitution at sentence, the court noted that restitution is not limited to just actual damages or loss. It may include more. But then when you look at AS 1255-100, which is in the second area where restitution is addressed, that's done as a provision of probation. So someone, as a condition of their probation, is being ordered restitution. That does seem to limit restitution to actual damages or loss. So the court noted that there seemed to be a conflict, and that while on one hand they could determine loss of income and other things, they would defer to the more restrictive one in this case, and commented in the case that they had inferred at other times it would be nice if the legislature worked this out. So the essence of what this bill does is it makes it clear in our public policy, as we go right to the section analysis, that we do want loss of income to be considered so that businesses can actually be restored for their labor, for their utilities, their taxes, insurance, supplies, and everything that goes into marketing an item for sale, and recognizing that what it costs to replace an item can include 2 or 3 weeks worth of backlog of other work to be made whole. So going right to the section analysis on the bill, Section 1 amends AS 1255-045, which is restitution as a direct provision of a defendant's sentence. It clarifies that our public policy favors requiring criminals to compensate their victims not only for damages and injury, but loss of income as well. And then Section 2 provides a definition for loss of income as the total loss of income a business or person suffers as a result of not having stolen property available during the time it takes to obtain a replacement. Section 3 amends this same part of the law to add a new subsection which directs the courts, when making determinations of loss or damage for restitution, to value the property as the market value of the property at the time and place the crime occurred, or if it cannot be reasonably ascertained, the cost of replacement within a reasonable period of time after the crime. And the language that was used was lifted right out of our Title 11 Criminal Code, which is what the court already uses in making determinations of property value in criminal cases involving property theft. So burglary, criminal trespass, vehicle theft, arson, things like that. Section 4 amends 1255-100, which is restitution as a condition of defendant's probation, clarifying how the court will value property when determining the amount of actual damages or loss under this paragraph, and establishes the same standard as in Section 3 dealing with 1255-045. So essentially, both sections of the law will now agree with one each other, recognizing that loss includes loss of income sets a definition, and reconciles the two so they're now in agreement with one another rather than seeming to be in conflict. Finally, Section 5 establishes that the amendments in Sections 1 through 4 of the Act apply to an order of restitution for an offense committed on or after the effective date of the Act. This bill has been received a lot of strong support from the Alaska Chamber of Commerce, National Federation of Independent Business, Alaska Chapter, and the Associated General Contractors of Alaska, who I believe are standing by to give support and examples of why this is important.
Thank you. Any questions from committee members? Online, I believe we have Casey Schroeder, who's the Special Assistant for the Department of Law. Ms. Schroeder, would you be interested in reviewing the fiscal note?
Sure. This is Casey Schroeder, the Criminal Division at the Department of Law. We don't have any issues with the bill, and we don't expect it to have any fiscal impact to the department at all.
Thank you. And the copy of the zero fiscal note is in the packet for committee members. Thank you. Is there anyone here in Juneau who would like to testify as a public comment section of the hearing? Okay, seeing none. Online, I see we have Mr. Chris Nettles. Mr. Nettles, you're with the National Federation of Independent Businesses. Would you like to testify?
Yes, thank you. I want to thank you for this opportunity to testify today. I am testifying on behalf of the National Federation of Independent Business Alaska Chapter and as a small business owner myself. I strongly support this bill and firmly believe that a crime is committed, that the perpetrator should not get an additional discount over and above the five-finger discount they already got. So I strongly believe that as a business owner, I would like to be, you know, restitution should actually pay me back for the actual, the market value of that product. I'm actually in a service business, and we've had numerous thefts occur over the last 15 years of our business being in Anchorage, Alaska. We also operate all over the state. And then one incident I can think of, we had a snow machine stolen in a village. Fortunately, in terms of it being stolen, it occurred after the end of the job instead of before the job. But had it occurred before the job, we probably would have lost that job because we weren't capable of performing it without the snow machine. And or we certainly would have been put on delay and probably suffered the cost of those delays with that contract. So not only does when a theft occur, it can drastically impact the ability of our business to continue and be successful in making that that contract come about. So it is a concern of mine, and I strongly support Senator McKinsey's bill and would like to also thank him for bringing this forward. That's all I've got for today.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Nettles? Seeing no questions, thank you. We also have Nancy Mead, who's here with the courts, if there are any questions from committee members for Ms. Mead. Seeing no questions. Mr. Kopp, so in the bill, the market value will be determined, and I'm curious who will be determining that value?
Market value is, of course, determined by the market itself, and how it's defined in the bill is that it's determined at the time and place of the crime, so it's in your area where it occurred, because the market value certainly would vary depending on where you were located. But how it's defined in the bill is market value of the property at the time and place of the crime, and if it cannot reasonably be established, the cost of replacement within a reasonable time after the crime. And that's where some businesses or individuals have pointed out to us that that this time delay can be very, very expensive. It may take them 2 weeks just to, somebody mentioned the copper wire, to get that copper wire, but in so doing, they have put back a whole bunch of subcontractors in line, and they said the dollar value of the loss is generally disproportionately large compared to the item that was stolen. And that can be a generator or a bobcat or a small piece of equipment, too.
Certainly.
Same thing would apply.
Thank you. And in our system of laws, will the value of the item increasing, will that change the level of the crime?
Well, the felony offense begins now at, actually we just changed this last year, I think it's $750 now.
Okay.
And it was $500. So you're still going to be at a Class C felony until you've hit the $25,000 mark. Senator Ellis was involved with this legislation as well, too. And then at that point, you go to a B felony. But that's we have a big range in there where you're at a C felony, and that's $750 all the way to $25,000.
And in regard to juveniles, I know there are some factors called mitigating factors. Would this be something that a judge can take into account that that the value under the, if we kept the law the way it is now, would be different than what we're doing here, which would add more value to it? I mean, would that be a mitigating factor? And we've been joined by Senator Meyer. Welcome.
A mitigating factor, I'm not sure I quite understood the question, Senator Cassell. Could you repeat that for me, too?
In sentencing, I think there are certain times where a judge can take into account mitigating factors,
yes.
And I was curious if this would be one of those, would fall into that, and maybe you're not the right one to answer the question. And
yeah, it may be a question for the court. You mean as far as our change to the law, or as far as someone's ability to pay back, or I'm not quite sure what would be the mitigating factor you're addressing?
The difference in the value of the item versus the market value.
Yes, now I understand.
Yeah.
I apologize.
And the loss that a business would incur.
Yes, the value being the market value of the item, and then if the loss was substantially more, as far as the effort, time, and other things that happen to replace that would be a factor, could be an aggravator, you know, as far as how the court would look at that. This gives the court direction. It doesn't mandate the court, but it definitely makes it clear in our public policy that we favor them looking at that whole picture, loss of income, and trying to reconcile our two statutes, so it makes it clear that we consider that to be important under either theory of restitution as sentencing or as condition of probation.
Thank you. Any questions from committee members? Senator Stevens.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I just took the time to read Mr. DeWitt's letter, and I don't think he's testifying, but if you could comment on that, I mean, as I read through his comments, it sort of shocked me to think about a commercial fishing boat. Someone damages a boat, it cannot operate. The season is about to begin. There's a captain, the owner, the crewman. I mean, we could be talking $500,000 pretty quickly. That would certainly raise the crime to a higher level, but this would, in fact, take care of that type of a situation.
Yes, it absolutely does. Through the chair, Senator Stevens, it would. And commercial fishing is an excellent example, because anything you do to a boat, whether it be so small that prohibits it from fishing or keeps it from being able to market its fish because it's disabled, could be drastic, yes.
Very interesting. Thank you.
Okay. Seeing no further questions from committee members, I will close public testimony. And with that, Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 5, version 29, LS0109/HELO, with attached zero fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Thank you, and I will take a brief at ease while we sign the document and wait for our next bill sponsor. Thank you. Thank you. I'm calling the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee back to order after short at ease to sign Senate Bill 21, or excuse me, Senate Bill 5's folder. And next on the agenda, we have Senate Bill 39, which has been introduced by Senator Bill Stoltz. Welcome to the committee, Senator Stoltz. And as I mentioned earlier, the plan for Senate Bill 39 is to have the sponsor and his staff present the legislation. And then we have here today the Deputy Commissioner Jerry Burnett and Brandon Spanos, who's the Deputy Director of Tax, is online for any questions. Also, the bill drafter is online for questions. We have those folks who are ready to answer any questions of committee members. And then we will hold the bill, and then on Tuesday, February 24th at 1:30, it will be a part of the agenda there to have public testimony. And so certainly we have people interested in this legislation, and if they're listening, we welcome them today to listen at our LIOs. However, we will be having the public testimony portion of this legislation on Tuesday, giving us a little more time for that so that people can plan in advance. So with that, welcome Senator Stoltz, and please feel free to explain your pretty straightforward bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My sincere apologies. I know there's not five more important people, and I've kept you all waiting while I was in another meeting. I do appreciate that. I'm Bill Stoltz. I represent Senate District F, Matsu, and the northern part of the municipality of Anchorage, a.k.a. Chugiak. Presenting Senate Bill 39, and I appreciate the deliberative approach which you're outlining. It's a significant program which certainly has had benefits to Alaska's economy, and it certainly had impacts on Alaska's treasury. It's a program which I have not been supportive of from the time we started it, even in a time of high revenues, as the use of that subsidy to support the an industry which I think we all enjoy in some features, in some facets. I like movies. I don't get to watch many of them these days, but the last one I watched might have been with you, Representative Costello.
With then Representative Fairclough, who's now Senator McKinnon. Yeah. So things change.
Yes. But the issues are now even more before us on the use of this subsidy, should it be to, whether it's still in the experimental mode of trying to create an economy with the film industry, which is still, I think it's up to broad debate of whether or not it's had a commensurate effect to the investment. I think it's indisputable that it's that these large expenditures of state funds have helped various vendors, caterers, hoteliers, and other aspects, whether or not it's been an investment that anyone would make with their own money, and certainly without even being a beneficiary of any of the receipts of a movie that's or a film production or one of the I'm at a deficit. I have TV here for a couple of months. Otherwise, I don't have TV at home. So I hear more about the reality shows. But my intent in not being supportive of this program in the past and being critical and making measures, it's not a punitive attack on an industry. I don't make subjective commentary on the qualitative nature of the productions. Some of them I think are universally praised. Some of them folks have very defined opinions on their own, and I don't think my voice on whether or not the subjective quality of movies is really irrelevant. My only involvement is because of the fiscal impacts which are right in our as much in our lap as anything is, and when we're talking about it's not money that it's not like there's $170 or $180 million sitting there now, but it's further exposure to our treasury as tax credits / subsidies are approved, and that's further exposure to the state treasury. So I don't think it's sustainable or viable. So it really is only a fiscal issue with me. Other Alaskans have expressed subjective views, both for and against, about the vitality or of the industry and what it produces, and some of it, we've all heard them, and I don't mean to repeat them, and you're probably not going to hear a lot of Alaskans showing up on a work day in the middle of the day to express what their opinion is on why this should be discontinued. They're busy working, and they don't have the same vested interests of those that are benefiting from the subsidy. So I expect you're going to hear a lot more from folks that are benefiting from the subsidy. And unless you happen to be in South Central listening to talk radio, you'll hear that unfiltered message, which I listen to in the morning as I'm working. And I think it's an interesting source. It's an unfiltered a source of information, not the only one, but it's certainly one I listen to as well, and it's been pretty heavily weighted there. Those are folks, as they're driving to and from work, there is a pretty definite opinion there. I can't quantify it. For every one person that calls in on a talk radio, there's 100 that are listening, minimum. But that's my subjective view on that, but so I don't expect you to have a lot of folks calling in. I'm not trying to drum up folks to call in. I think there's there's intuitiveness of people that have their opinions on government. You're going to hear from folks that have concerns about the spending issue, and you'll hear from them maybe not through direct testimony, but through other venues as they communicate to you and as you attend your public meetings, if you were to ask them to compare this with other state spending. I don't have a lot of detailed testimony. As you said, it's a fairly straightforward, but with a lot of wrinkles and complications. There are Alaskans that have participated and benefited, but it's up to you as policymakers to determine whether or not this is the most appropriate way to spend scarce resources. And that's one that I won't speak for the chief executive, but he is suspended, as it's been described in the press. I haven't had a conversation with him about what that actually means. I've certainly heard undercurrents that I don't know, we'll make sure this one gets approved. That's up to him and his administration as they deal with the public. But I'm taking the governor at good faith that he views this as there's an expenditure in these times that we can't afford. So if I can try to go in more depth, then I have to start acting, and I'm not an actor.
Thank you for that presentation of Senate Bill 39. Would you like to have your staff, Daniel George, go through the sectional at this time?
At the pleasure of the committee, Madam Chair.
If you will, thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. For the record, my name is Daniel George, staff to Senator Bill Stoltz. I will go through the sectional briefly. We also, I will note, have Emily Nauman, the drafter from Legislative Legal Services, online. This bill has wrinkles in several different years in statutes, going all back to 2008 when it was first added to statute. The original five-year $100 million appropriation expired in 2013, was reauthorized for an additional 10 years. And under House Bill 306, which is now Session Law of Alaska, last year in the 28th legislature, was sunset. The film production tax credit was sunset December 31st, 2018. So it would still be $200 million that were authorized for that 10-year period, but that has a sunset date of 2018. Beginning with Section 1, Section 1 removes a reference to the film tax credit, the fisheries business tax from refunds to local governments. This is a whole harmless provision, so that when the state offers a tax credit, it doesn't reduce revenues that otherwise would go to local governments, and I believe that Legislative Legal Services can explain that further if necessary. Section 2 removes the same provision from the future effective date, 2016. This is House Bill 306. Again, there are some provisions that take effect in the future. Section 3 of the bill deals with the Fisheries Resource Lending Tax. It removes the film tax credit from eligibility for that tax. Section 4 removes a reference to the film tax credit from revenue sharing. This is as it is under House Bill 306. Again, from the last legislature with an effective date 2016. So you can see how this gets a little bit complicated. Section 5 makes amendments conforming with the repeal of the film office and all of the subsections under the film office qualifications, awards, and regulations, and so on. Section 6 removes a reference to the film tax credit from House Bill 306 relating to the immediate effective date. This would be taking out the sunset in 2018. Section 7 repeals the duty of the Legislative Audit Division to conduct audits of the Film Production Incentive Program, the Film Production Tax Credit, the Film Production Incentive Program, and the administration of the Film Production Incentive Program. Section 8 repeals in 2021 the section that allows for recovery of film production tax credits after the repeal. It's an audit provision that allows the state to go back for damages. It gives a six-year sunset on that ability. Section 9 repeals multiple sections of the original authorization of Senate Bill 23 in the 27th legislature, as well as House Bill 306 in the 28th legislature relating to the film tax credit. There's a lot of statute cleanup that's necessary. Section 10 provides transition language for repeal of the film tax credit. The effective date of the repeal of the film tax credit is July 1st, 2015. Section 11 repeals certain sections of the 2012 renewal of the film tax credit, and sections 12 through 15 provide effective dates for the bill. That is the bill, Madam Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Stoltz, would you like to add comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I neglected to in my introduction. I introduced this bill previously last year, and working with Representative Thompson, now chairing Finance, we pulled back on the bill to repeal because we put it under the we drew straws on which program would hit the audits first, and the film credits were going to be audited in 2016. And the other body, and I guess now this body, there was a floor amendment that removed that 2016, moved it back a couple years, and that leaves more exposure to the state. But so I had already viewed the audit provisions and examining it as a compromise and withdrawn it. So and I operated in good faith, and the folks that voted in good faith in their way. But that's why I'm now before it. I think 2018 was far too long to wait to examine it. But I thought 2016 was a reasonable time, and certainly that timeline has really been pushed up by circumstances we weren't imagining just even last year. And just that historical part, I've neglected to leave that off, but that was part of the whole discussion of the film industry tax credit / subsidy. And that compromise sort of evaporated far too late in the session to do anything else about it. So now this we're back before it with even more urgency.
Thank you. Are there any questions of the bill sponsor or staff from the committee members? Thank you, Senator Stoltz and Mr. George, for presenting the legislation. Today we also have with us Jerry Burnett, the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Revenue. And welcome, Mr. Burnett. You have provided to the committee some information that I was hoping that you would review regarding the program. And for those folks who are listening online, once again, I wanted to mention the importance of the public testimony. So we have planned that public testimony for Tuesday of next week, during the regularly scheduled Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. So with that, Mr. Burnett.
Yeah, for the record, Jerry Burnett, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Revenue. And I'd like to start out, I have two reports that I think you've been provided with, and I'll start out with the one that goes from 2009 to 2013. But before that, one specific question is the exposure of this the continued exposure. So far under the current program, which started on July 1st, 2013, there's been $28.3 million in credits that have been approved, which leaves $171,700,000 in potential tax credits out there between now and 2018 under the current statute. Okay, so if you go back to 2009, which I think you have a sheet like this in your packet, you can look and see that we've approved, and this was under the Department of Commerce and Economic Development. It was a previous iteration of the film tax credit. A total credits of about $38 million. And that was for 11 commercials, 19 documentaries, 29 feature films, 65 TV nonfiction, one TV drama. And the chart shows the expenditures that were made during that period that were reported of about $117 million during that period. So during that approximately five-year period, fairly significant economic impact if you think of multipliers from the industry.
Mr. Burnett, do you mind explaining briefly how the credit works?
Okay. So, and I'll go to the credit now, how it works. Right now, a commercial entity that wants to have a film tax credit makes an application with an application fee to the Alaska Film Incentive Commission, which it consists of four commissioners: the Commissioner of Labor, Natural Resources, Commerce, Economic Development, Commerce, Community and Economic Development, and the Department of Revenue, or their designees. So there's four commissioner appointments on that board. There's a detailed application with an application fee, which is reviewed by the executive director of the film office, who's in the tax division. Recommendations are made to that board. Because these are commercial operations, that's all confidential information, the specific business plans, etc. So no one sees, those four commissioners and the staff in the tax division are the ones that see those actual applications. And they, then the film tax, or the Film Incentive Commission makes a decision on each of these whether or not it can be qualified.
And
now, after qualification,
is there an appeal process? Okay.
Okay, and then if it's not, they can be appealed. And because of the nature of this, they're appealed under the Administrative Procedure Act. There has been one appeal, and that appeal actually resulted in a reconsideration vote by the commission, and they did approve the application for that bill, as it turns out. But there is an appeal provision, just like any other administrative action. But because these are agency discretion, and the nature of is the there's a very narrow appeal opportunity, it has to be a case where they're arbitrary and capricious in making a decision, or they didn't do the process correctly. It's not something where you can say, well, we said this, and it's different than some other appeals. Mm-hmm. So anyway, there is an appeal process. Okay, once it's qualified, then the entity goes out, does their work, they report their expenditures to the tax division, they're approved for credit, and they receive a transferable credit certificate, which then they can sell to a taxpayer and reduce that, and that taxpayer can use it to reduce their tax liability.
Okay. So, Thank you for that explanation.
Okay, so looking at how it worked from 2000, what was happened from 2009 to 2013, law was changed and went into effect on July 1st, 2013. And so the second report, which you just actually was released publicly yesterday, as it turns out, is the first annual report under the new program.
And excuse me, members, are you do you have that report?
It looks like this.
I believe so.
Okay, let me take a brief at ease.
Okay, it should be in your...
Meeting is called back to order. Thank you for that.
Okay, so under the statute that passed under 4425, the report is supposed to include the number of applications received, the number of applications approved, the number of amount of tax credits dispersed, the total amount of expenditures that were paid for qualifying for the film production tax that were not qualified expenditures, the total amount of qualified expenditures, the total amount of qualified expenditures that were paid by productions qualifying for the film production tax credit to Alaska residents, the total amount paid by productions qualifying the production tax credit for wages paid to individuals who are not residents, and then the total number of residents employed, total number of individuals employed, and the number of productions qualifying for the film production credit that used a third party to sell, assign, exchange, convey, or otherwise transfer, whole and part of tax credit certificate, and the number of purchases of transferable film production tax credit certificates. So that's what the report is supposed to have in it, I believe it does. But if you look on the left-hand column, for fiscal year 2014, it is just showing what was paid in tax credits that were dispersed but were qualified under the program that existed prior to July 1, 2013, which was $5,543,701.
And Mr. Burnett, if you don't mind just mentioning to the committee and those who have a copy, who are following along, what line on the left?
Okay, that's line number 8. So that's the tax credits dispersed. So I'm going over the first column to the left. The number, lines 9 through 9A through line D show the number, the types of productions that were there. Television series, documentaries, feature films, commercial advertisements. Now, line 10 shows the total amount of expenditures that were qualified expenditures. Then if you move to the second page, then you'll see the total amount of qualified expenditures that were paid by productions qualifying for the film tax credit to established Alaska businesses. And then the total amount that were paid by productions qualifying for the film production tax credit to Alaska residents as wages. And then the total amount of, on line 14, the total amount that were paid by productions qualifying from the film production tax credit for wages paid to individuals who are not residents. And then line 16 shows the number of residents at work, so that's 188. And line 17 shows the number of non-residents that worked on these films. And line 18 is the number of amount of expenditures that were not for qualified expenditures. So there's expenditures that qualify and not qualify that are shown on here. The reason I'm wanting to go through 13 is because 14 doesn't show much data. And the reason 14 doesn't show much data is because when we get to the top of the page, on line number 1, it shows that in fiscal year 14, we actually qualified 50 productions, or received 50 production applications, and approved 40 of those 50. And it shows on lines 2A through 2D what types of productions those were. Number 3 is the estimated tax credits approved. So that's for those 40 productions, they're estimating that their expenditures will result in tax credits of $18,293. And that's fiscal year 14. Now, you go There were eight applications rejected. There were one withdrawn, one still under review at the end of the fiscal year. There were two tax credits dispersed, so we can't talk about how much those tax credits were for because we don't have three or more taxpayers. Mm-hmm. So we have to be able to aggregate information to talk about the specifics of the tax credits that were in FY14 under that program. You notice that there's $5 million under the other program that we did. But so that's why we have then the column, which is calendar year 2014, which actually has some information in it. Again, received 40 applications, approved 24 for $16 million. But we still only had four tax credits that were finalized and paid in calendar 14 for a total of $585,984.
Mr. Burnett, there's a time period where the taxpayer has a period of time in order to use that those credits. Are there any outstanding ones that have not been applied?
To the chair, you are the chair, so I believe there are. And I don't know what those are, and if I did, I probably couldn't tell you. So.
Because of the confidential...
Right, I might be able to tell you the amounts of the total amount, but we can try to find that information for the committee. But I believe there are outstanding tax credits that have been awarded and not yet redeemed. So, but in any event, qualified expenditures that were under this program, so this tells you a little bit about the time from the time they get qualified until a production actually is done and accounted for, is that from July 1 to the end of 2014, there were only $1.4 million in qualified expenditures that were made under this program for ones that had been approved during that period of time. And going on, the qualified expenditures were $601,000. And the small numbers after that, 64, if you go to line 17, there were, or actually go to line 16, there were 91 residents who worked on those four productions. And on line 17, there were 64 productions, there are 64 non-residents, and on line 18, $11 million worth of non-qualifying expenditures for those four productions.
Mr. Burnett, so as far as the employment of Alaskans, which is what the sort of the rewrite was focusing on, mm-hmm. is the investment in Alaskan jobs and the investment in Alaskan companies, are those full-time equivalent, or are those actual Alaskans, and we're not necessarily sure if it's a full...
Madam Chair, that is the total number of individuals.
Okay, so we're not...
That's not full-time year-round employment. That's the number of individuals that are reported.
Okay, thank you.
Paid. So, I think that's the information that we really have on the program. There has been two meetings of the Film Incentive Commission since the beginning of 2015, which aren't in the report, and they did approve one, but I can't talk about it because it's just one. So, but one was approved at a January meeting.
Thank you. Any questions from committee members? Mr. Burnett, Senator Stoltz had mentioned briefly the governor's recent action in relation to this program. Could you share with the committee what that was and how that affects the program?
Okay, so in the FY16 governor's budget, the one that's before the finance committees, the funding for the staff in the Alaska Film Office and the Department of Revenue was removed. The practical effect of that under AS 4425110 is that statute says that we will, subject to appropriation, operate the film office. So assuming that budget goes through as is, the Film Incentive Commission would not meet. We would not take applications after July 1 under this program. We would still continue to process any qualified credits from previous times. The other part of this is that given the current fiscal situation, it's very unlikely that an application would be approved by the Incentive Commission were they to receive an application and meet in the current situation, because of one of the conditions for approving these is the effects, looking at the effects on the state's fiscal climate. And this program, while it may well be a very good program, the governor's action suspends the program as of July 1. Pays the previously approved credits and work that's done on those films, but suspends it going forward. We have no specific position on Senator Schultz's bill. His bill eliminates the program completely. Our actions suspend the program, you know, pending further fiscal review. So that would be the difference between what the governor's action is and what Senator Schultz's action is.
And Mr. Burnett, what's the practical difference between the governor's action and the legislation before us then?
Well, the practical difference is that if let's say we change the fiscal system, the fiscal climate, 2 years from now or 1 year from now, and we were back before the legislature and someone wanted to restore the budget, you wouldn't have to pass new legislation to reinstate the program.
And I just actually have one final question. Both the sponsor of the legislation and you have mentioned the fiscal situation, and I thought for the members of the public who are interested in this legislation and who are listening, could you just briefly characterize the fiscal situation?
Okay, I could. When I took this job in December, my first meeting with the governor was actually going over the revenue forecast, mm-hmm. the new updated December revenue forecast. The state of Alaska will be bringing in somewhere around 40% of the general fund revenue that it's expending in FY15. So that's a deficit somewhere more than potentially more than $3.5 billion. That money has to come out of savings in order to pay for the budget. The state has ample savings for the next several years. I think the good news is that we're doing exactly what the legislature and the administration over the past 25 years has planned for and done. We save money when we have money, and we continue to spend money at a lower level when we don't have it, and use the savings accounts and the capital budget as shock absorbers. And I think that's the same kind of thing. But going forward from 2015 to 16, that deficit appears to be staying in place, and it may even be worse than what we predicted. So that's the concern. And the film tax incentive legislation is a situation where it's not consistent with the fiscal structure that the state of Alaska has. That is to say, these are non-taxpayers who are producing economic activity in Alaska, which is a very good thing, but regardless of the activity, they don't bring very much revenue into the state coffers. So from the state's perspective as a operating entity, this is a subsidy, it's a reduction in our revenues. It's a specific reduction in our revenues. Some other states with similar programs may have broad-based taxes where the economic activity pays back the state government for the additional activity, but this one doesn't. And when the state has sufficient money, it makes a lot of sense to incent economic activity of this type.
Any questions from committee members? Senator Stevens.
Thank you, I'm sure. Just a little confusion here. I'm looking at your fiscal note, and the sentence that says this bill provides that any tax credits pre-approved by July 1st would still be allowed. July 1st of 2015, which is several months away. And you seem to be implying that the commission would not be approving. You would not expect the commission to approve. So maybe you can explain that a little bit better.
Well, it could be, and then I said I don't expect them to approve, but there could be a situation where they could approve one, and I can't speak for the members of the commission.
And they all have jobs for the governor, right?
Right. Yeah. We know who they are and where they're employed, so it's highly unlikely unless there were some special circumstance that made an application stick out.
And a follow-up, Madam Chair, is there any difference between the governor's suspension and the bill in front of us on that July 1st date? Is that stays the same on either one?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, I believe it stays the same on either one.
Thank you.
Okay. Seeing no other questions, thank you, Mr. Burnett, and thank you, members, for hearing the presentation today. And on February 24th, our next meeting will be at 1:30 in this room. We will have bills previously heard along with some boards and commissions appointments, and then we will have public testimony on Senate Bill 39. And with that, the meeting is adjourned at 2:40 in the afternoon.